Hello, I'm Eric Cohen. This is number 0568, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0568. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Peter James, author of the amazing Detective Superintendent Roy Gray series of thrillers, he's coming out with his 16th novel in the series called Find Them Dead.
There's a lot of me in Roy Grace, and a lot of the things that he gets angry about and feels strongly about are issues that I feel concerned about as well. And, you know, I guess the only difference between myself and Roy is he's a lot braver than I am.
Terence Winkless is the author of From the Inside, My Life as Bingo of the Banana Splits. He and his two brothers made up three of the four Banana Splits.
My dad wrote Kellogg's commercials. He worked for the Leah Burnett Agency in Chicago. And he spent a lot of time going to L.A. to supervise making of them. Through that, he became friendly with Hanna and Barbera, the cartoon guys. And he became aware that they were going to make this TV show, and he said, I've got just the guys to be in those costumes.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and it's Batter Up here on Book Banter, as I fondly recall 35 years of Montreal Expo's history with Always Remembered. So buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack, and I will be back later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0568, was Eric Cohen. He's a journalist, a producer, a musician, and the hardest working man in showbiz. You can also check out his YouTube channel, Air Drum Showdown, a series of air drum showdowns with other passionate drummers. Check it out. And thank you very much, Eric, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? If you love something, set it free. If it doesn't return, then climb down the chimney and make it love you. Yeah, that might have been what one woman was thinking when she was discovered stuck in a chimney of a South California house and had to be rescued. Ventura County Fire Captain Ron Oatman says firefighters responding to neighbors' reports of a crying woman had to chisel away much of the chimney and lubricate it with dish soap to free 30-year-old Genoveva Nunez Figueroa. She was arrested on suspicion of illegal entry and giving false information to police. Police said Nunez Figueroa knows the owner of the home, who wasn't there at the time. They wouldn't elaborate, but according to video of the homeowner, he identified the woman as someone he met online and had dated. He told local news that he cut off their relationship. I wonder why. She had no clear injuries, but was taken to a hospital for evaluation. In other words, a checkup from the neck up. Said the homeowner about the future bunny boiler, I hope she gets help. I hope she stays offline.
I just want to be a part of your life.
Oh, this is the way you do it, huh? Showing up at my apartment?
Well, what am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored.
Well, we've also ruled out the chimney. I think I speak for most men when I say, let's hope she stays single. Now, late last year, the state of Idaho ranked first as the dumbest state. Honestly, that really happened. Now, this year, it received another number one score, most UFO sightings per capita. In 2019, Idahoans reported 164 UFOs to the National UFO Reporting Center. Wow. I really don't have anything to add to this except to say that maybe just maybe, that first ranking might have something to do with the second ranking. Yeah. A 72-year-old California woman trying to take photos of a bison was gored by the animal at Yellowstone National Park. The woman, who was not identified, sustained multiple goring wounds and was flown to an Idaho hospital. She approached within 10 feet of a bison multiple times to take its photo. Gotta tell you, it's only slightly less dangerous trying to take a picture of Alec Baldwin. Said Yellowstone senior bison biologist Chris Jeremiah, the bison most likely felt threatened after being repeatedly approached. Again, that's probably how Alec Baldwin feels. The park urges people to stay away from wildlife and to keep at a minimum of 25 yards away from animals like bison and elk. Bison are wild animals that respond to threats by displaying aggressive behaviors, Jeremiah said. If that doesn't make the threat move away, a threatened bison may charge. Bison attacks on humans have occurred in Yellowstone before, including just last month. They are massive animals, and bull bisons can weigh up to 2,000 pounds. A bison can run at speeds of up to 35 miles per hour. So, Grandma got gored by a bison. Yeah, we'll all be singing that next Christmas. By the way, I'm not convinced that it is COVID-19 that will kill off humanity. It will be the hunt for selfies. That'll do it. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, as I tell this next story, please try to contain your surprise at the outcome. 44-year-old Alexander Feaster was arrested in Hunter, Oklahoma, and charged with the June 28th shooting of an unnamed 26-year-old woman who had been attending a party across the street from Feaster's property. Garfield County Sheriff Jody Helm said that on a dare, the woman had tried to steal one of two Nazi flags displayed on Feaster's front yard. But on the way back, someone hollered gun. She dropped the flag and shots were fired. Police, executing a search warrant on the home, found more than a dozen guns and ammunition. Feaster was charged with assault and battery with a deadly weapon and shooting with intent to kill. The woman is expected to survive. Now, again, boys and girls, are we surprised?
Please won't you be my neighbor?
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in 2016, I had the pleasure of talking to novelist Peter James. At the time, he was on a press tour talking about the 12th novel in his Detective Superintendent Roy Gray series of thrillers. I had never read his work. Clearly, I had come late to this party. But flash forward to now, and Peter is releasing the 16th novel in the series, this one called Find Them Dead. And, like all of his rabid fans, I have now devoured the first 15 books and am clamoring for the release of this latest tome. Peter joins us via Skype once again, this time from Jersey in the British Isles. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter. Great to see you again.
Great to have you on the program once again. I always enjoy talking to you. And as I said in the introduction, I had not read your books before I talked to you the first time. But after that conversation, I couldn't put them down. So here we are.
There's nothing nicer than actually meeting someone who hasn't read the books, because hopefully you can persuade them to have a go and then maybe they'll like them and you've got a new reader.
Yeah. And as I've mentioned on this program several times, normally I do not read the books of guests before I have them on the program because I want to be in the same situation as the audience, learning stuff about the book and the author as I go along. So this interview is actually going to be a little difficult because I know too much about Roy Grace. But having said that, I know I've asked this question in the past, but you've done now 16 of these. How far in advance do you know about a particular story or a particular thread before you get to it?
Well, I love a mixture when I write of planning and spontaneity. So I'm always thinking, because I do so much research, for me, research is such a key part of writing. I go out with the police every couple of weeks in the UK and in other countries as well. So I'm always planning about 3 years ahead of the Roy Grace books I'm going to write. And an opportunity comes to do some research, then I do it. But when I'm actually planning a book, I'm a great believer in a combination of planning and spontaneity. I like to structure a book to a certain extent. I like to know like roughly the first 20%, first 100 pages. And I like to know the ending as a kind of vanishing point on the horizon to get to. But once I get into the book, I love it when something pops in my head that wasn't there 10 seconds ago. And I've always said, you know, if you don't surprise yourself as the author, you're never going to surprise your readers.
Now, as I said, when I first spoke to you in 2016, that's only 4 years ago, you were out talking about your 12th novel. This is now 16. So you're very prolific in that period of time. And Detective Superintendent Roy Grace, that series, that's not the only thing you've written in that time span. So how quick of a writer are you?
I'm not that quick, but I've written two standalones in that period. I wrote Absolute Proof, which is my thriller about what would happen if somebody claimed to conclusively prove God existed. And I wrote a ghost story, the sequel to The House on Cold Hill, which is called The Secret of Cold Hill, which has just come out in paperback. I love writing my Roy Grace novels, but they take me about 7 months from the time I write the first sentence to the last. And then there's about 4 months of editing process. But I also love sometimes to write a standalone about a theme that I don't think I could really explore in a Roy Grace novel. And in fact, I think, as you know, I used to live in Toronto many years ago, back in the 70s, and I have family in Canada, and I have a family mystery, which is an aunt of mine, my mother's sister, who was, they were all Jewish refugees from Austria. And in 1968, my mother's sister, Erica, went over the Niagara Falls. And there's always been this mystery about, did she jump or did her husband push her? And I'm going to write that as my next standalone, because it doesn't work in the context of Roy Grace, but it's something I've long wanted to explore and write about.
Mm. Yeah, we should mention, for those who don't know, Roy Grace is a detective in Brighton, England. So, yeah, he wouldn't be doing something at Niagara Falls. When you write these books, again, number 16 is now out. Do you still learn something about Roy Grace that you didn't know before?
Yeah, constantly. And I love that too. I love Roy Grace has got, you know, his team, and quite a few of them are regulars. There's Glenn Branson, his partner and his longtime buddy now, and the terribly politically incorrect Norman Potting, and various others, the same members of the team. And when I start a new Roy Grace book, I always kind of sit down and I go, hi, everybody, how have you been? Norman Potting, who have you offended recently? And there's a lot of me in Roy Grace, and a lot of the things that he gets angry about and feels strongly about are issues that I feel concerned about as well. And, you know, I guess the only difference between myself and Roy is he's a lot braver than I am.
Tell us what the story of Find Them Dead is about.
Find Them Dead, at its heart, is about a 43-year-old mother, Meg McGowan. And we learn that 5 years earlier, her husband and son were killed in a horrible car crash when they were all on their way back from a family holiday. Family vacation, and she and her 18-year-old teenage daughter survived. And her daughter, now 18, is absolutely everything she has in the world. She completely dotes on the girl. And the daughter goes off for a gap year, traveling in South America with her best friend. And the mother, Meg, gets summoned onto jury service, onto the trial of a major drugs overlord. And on the third day of the trial, basically, she comes home, and there's a photograph of her daughter in Ecuador sitting on the kitchen table. And Meg's thinking, how the hell Who took that? How did he get on the kitchen table? And that moment her phone rings and a sinister stranger says to her, we know where your daughter is every second of every day. If you ever want to see her alive again at the end of the trial, the jury has to say two words and you know what they are.
Wow. Ooh, I want to read that one even more now. One of the things that's always interesting about the book, and again, I don't want to give anything away in talking about this, but you weave a little bit of personal facts about the characters in each book. Is that something that you have come to organically? Was that something you decided to do from the very original book and it just carried on? How do you weave the personal stories of the characters? And it's, and again, it's just enough that it doesn't get in the way.
Thank you. Back in 1982, I just had my first ever novel published, a really bad spy thriller, which I don't recommend you ever read, called Dead Letter Drop. And we got burgled, and a young detective came to take fingerprints. He saw the book. He said, if you ever want research help with the police, give me a call. And that was the start of my relationship with initially Sussex Police and then more broadly other police forces in the UK. And this guy, Mike Harris, was married to a detective, and they invited my then wife and I to a barbecue at their house. And all dozen of their friends there were also cops, everything traffic, response, homicide. And I found these guys and females fascinating to talk to. And I realized that nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a cop. And over the years, as I started going out more and more with the police, we'd often end up at some dreadful situation, a horrible murder, a dreadful road accident. And yet these people had to, at the end of their shift, go back home to their families. One police officer of mine tried to resuscitate a 3- and 5-year-old boy and sister who'd been suffocated by their mother in a revenge act on her father. And he tried to resuscitate them and then had to go home utterly traumatized and bathe his own kids and put them to bed. And I realized, you know, we see just these people, these detectives, we see the cops in uniform. What we don't see is the other side of their lives, that they are loving, caring human beings, often family people. They have their relationship difficulties. And also they suffer trauma. The head of the Met Police a few years ago said that wearing a uniform does not protect you from trauma. And that's always fascinated me. It's in addition to obviously the homicide side, it's what are they like as human beings behind that uniform?
One of the things I'm most excited about is the fact that Roy Grace is now coming to television. ITV has announced that you're going to release the first two books in television form, and I understand you're doing all of your books eventually. You must be excited about that.
I am beyond thrilled. ITV is a tremendous company. The whole production team are great. The writer, Russell Lewis, is a writer I respect probably more than any other television crime writer in the UK, if not the world. And the great thing is that the actor playing Roy Grace is John Sim, who is not only a wonderful actor, he is exactly how I had imagined Roy Grace would look when I first created him. And John's father-in-law, his wife's father, was 35 years a copper in the Metropolitan Police in London. And John said he always shouts at the screen when people get it wrong. And John shares my absolute passion for getting it right.
Yeah, I remember reading the last book, and I won't give the scene away, but you talk about a situation where they find a body and you explain how this is always something that they get wrong in television, where they traipse around the crime scene. And I knew exactly which television show you were referring to.
Yeah, I just think it's, you know, if you're depicting something, get it right. Mm. It's not that hard.
Last question I want to ask, and that is purely for selfish reasons. How much longer do you think you can continue to write Roy Grace novels? And please tell me it's forever.
As long as lovely folk like you and all my lovely readers out there are enjoying the books, I'm going to keep writing. I'm already quarter of the way through the 17th book, and I have plans for the next three that I'm already starting to research. I will go on writing these hopefully forever. I just love writing them. I can't imagine not writing them.
And do you ever worry, because hopefully I'm assuming that this show, the television show, is going to become very successful. Are you at all worried that what is depicted on the screen will any way, shape, or form affect how you write Roy Grace in the future?
Well, it's I think that's a really clever question, because I've talked to one or two writers who've had their books, their detectives, televised, and they say they can't help but thinking of the television character when they write the next book. So I'm guessing that I shall probably have John Sim very much in mind when I write the following Roy Grace. But the great thing is, as he already looks like him anyway, there won't be too much of a problem. But I'm sure there will be some influence.
Well, however he develops, I'm sure it'll be great because, again, the first 15 were phenomenal. I'm looking forward to the 16th one. It's called Find Them Dead. I thank you very much, Peter, for being on the program with us once again.
Peter, so good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Peter James, author of the excellent Roy Grace thrillers. He really is my favorite thriller writer. The latest novel is called Find Them Dead. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0568. And you'll find links to Peter's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. I've already ordered mine for the Kindle. I can't wait. If you haven't read any of the Roy Grace books, start from the beginning. You won't regret it. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
Still to come on the program, we'll speak to Bingo from the Banana Splits. Plus, Stuart Nolman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on here on The Stuff File Program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Now, let's get back to the stuff. 22-year-old fisherman Dawson Cody Porter of Eagle River, Alaska, was arrested June 27th outside the Fisherman's Bar after arriving there driving a stolen fire truck with its emergency lights flashing. Bristol Bay Borough Police said Porter broke into the King Salmon Fire Station around 9 p.m., where he started the truck and drove it through the station's closed bay doors, making his way west on the Alaska Peninsula Highway about 15 miles to Naknek. Police Chief John Ryshek said Porter caused about $10,000 in damage and put the fire truck out of commission while repairs are made to it. You know, deep down inside, almost every kid wants to get behind the wheel of a fire truck. But unless we actually become firefighters, we tend to outgrow that burning desire. And we hardly ever think of flaming out by crashing through giant bay doors either. I'm guessing it will be a very long time before Dawson ever drives again or goes fishing. His freedom has been extinguished. A man that was caught on video swimming in the indoor aquarium at Bass Pro Shop in Bossier City, Louisiana, has been identified and arrested by police. According to the Bossier City Police Department, the not-so-aptly named 26-year-old Kevin Wise of Slidell is charged with simple criminal damage to property, which is a misdemeanor. The video shows Wise swimming in the fish tank, climbing out of it, and then running out of the Bass Pro Shop. BCPD said Wise returned to the store and was subsequently arrested by citation and released on a summons to appear in court. A complaint was filed to Bossier City Police after Bass Pro Shop determined that there would be costs associated with emptying and cleaning the 13,000-gallon aquarium, which features species of fish local to the region. Apparently, the Wise guy named Wise is a TikTok user who was looking for his 5 minutes of fame. Well, mission accomplished. His video isn't on TikTok, but his story has worked its way around the globe. However, I'm sure his video will play well in court. You know, if you teach a man to fish, these kind of things won't happen. A Florida woman was arrested after she called 911 four times asking for a ride to another city. 31-year-old Sarah Alame called the emergency response line at 2:45 a.m. and said hello before hanging up. Officers went to the location of the call and didn't find anyone. She made a second call at 3 a.m. and the call was disconnected. When officers arrived, they found Alame in a hospital parking lot. She told them she had called and needed a ride. The officer warned her that 911 is for emergency calls only and told her to leave the property unless she needed medical help. Alame walked away and called 911 again to complain about the officer. According to police, the officer didn't give her the service she needed, a taxpayer-sponsored taxi ride. Officers told Alame not to call 911 again unless she had an emergency, but she called a fourth time. She was taken to the Polk County Jail and charged with one count of misuse of 911. Just one count? She called four times. Anyway, let's look at the bright side. Now she doesn't have to get a ride to another city. She can be comfy and cozy in jail. And police in Michigan said an alleged drunk driver pulled into the county jail parking lot and thought she had arrived at another bar. The Van Buren County Sheriff's Office said the 39-year-old Hartford woman, whose name was not released, pulled into the county jail parking lot at just after 2 a.m. and was seen trying to convince her boyfriend to get back into her vehicle. Deputies said the woman smelled heavily of alcohol and a breathalyzer test indicated her blood alcohol content was more than twice the legal limit of 0.08. Police said the woman admitted to investigators that she had been out drinking at a bar and she had believed the parking lot was for another bar. She is expected to face drunken driving-related charges. Now, this is yet another reason why drunk drivers need a navigational system in their vehicles. Seriously, how drunk do you have to be to think that a police station is a bar? Well, actually, we already know that. More than twice the legal limit. Yeah. Anyway, when she gets out, I hope she leaves a decent tip. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in 1968, Cartoon King's Hanna-Barbera created their first live-action show. It was the Banana Splits Adventure Hour. The Banana Splits were Flegel, Bingo, Drooper, and Snorky. Well, now there is a new book out, written by the man who was inside the Bingo costume. That would be Terrence Winkless. His book is called From the Inside, My Life as Bingo of the Banana Splits. He joins us on the line from Vancouver. Hi, Terrence.
Hi, how you doing, man?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I got to tell you right off the bat, that show came on the air when I was 10 years old, and I was in love with that show and never gave much thought to who might ever be inside the costumes.
I heard from one fan recently whose mother had told him, no, there are people inside the suits, and the kid was so disappointed. We've since made up for it and connected, you know, through the internet.
Now that
he knows I'm a human being and that I cared, it seemed to make all the difference.
One of the things I find very interesting about the story is the fact that not only were you inside the costume, but two of your brothers were also doing this as well. So the three Winkless boys were inside four of those costumes. How did that come to be?
My dad wrote Kellogg's commercials. He worked for the Lea Burnett Agency in Chicago. And he spent a lot of time going to L.A. to supervise making of them. And through that, he became friendly with Hanna and Barbera, the cartoon guys. And he became aware that they were going to make this TV show. And he said, I've got just the guys to be in those costumes. So I drove home from college on a Friday, and my mother said, you're going to go to California on Monday and try out for this show, you and your brothers. I said, fine by me, boss. I'm ready to go. So we flew to California. They guided us to this room where the costumes were, and the rest is history. I can go into more detail if you like, but
well,
ask another question.
I'm just curious. I mean, besides the fact that your dad was just that, a proud father of his kids,
right.
What was the idea behind him saying, I've got the perfect guys for you? What were your backgrounds to be able to do this?
Well, yeah, we were all the right age. We were young. We were athletic. We'd all done some kind of theater at Nutria High School in Winnetka, Illinois. And so he knew we would have the chops, and anything we didn't have, he knew we could learn. We weren't entirely aware of, you know, the camera and which direction to look and stuff like that, but on that show it didn't really make much difference. But he knew that we would figure it out, and we did.
Now, when you look back at some of the things that the Banana Splits did, they could be deemed as early music videos back then because of some of the songs and some of the locations they had you guys in. And people can go online and take a look at some of the old stuff. I'm just curious to know what it was like inside that costume, not just on set in the studio, but you were in San Francisco driving on a car across the Golden Gate Bridge. You were on the cable cars, and I'm thinking, that's got to be hot.
On a cable car and driving across the bridge, it wasn't too bad. The tricky part of both of those was seeing anything, because we had only about 25% of our vision. And I'll never forget when that cop pulled us over right after we'd gone across the Golden Gate Bridge several times. A cop pulled us over, and I don't know, he didn't ticket my brother who was driving inside the Flegal costume. He didn't say anything to my other brother and me riding in back, but that was why he pulled us over. Because Danny and I were sitting up in the back of the, you know, the when you put the top down on a convertible, there's that top area, and that photographs very well. So, of course, we were sitting up there. That's why he pulled us over. He didn't say a word about, hey, buddy, you can't drive with that big head on. It was the damnedest thing.
Now,
I think he was just charmed by it.
Now, there were four Banana Splits. As I've already mentioned, three of them were Winkless boys. Who was the fourth, and how did he feel not being part of your family?
Well, the fourth initially was a guy named Jimmy Dove, who was recruited from inside Hanna-Barbera. He was in a different department, the Xerox department or something. And indeed, he was a little resentful of the fact that the three of us were brothers, and there was this immediate bond that he had nothing to do with. However, he did not last. He just didn't have the chops. The reason he was in the costume at all was only that he was the right size for it. But after a few weeks, I think four maybe, they said, let's get a real actor. So they went out and recruited Robert Towers, who would have been in Charlie Brown, playing Snoopy. And so, you know, he was the real deal. He still is the real deal.
Mm. How many years did you end up playing Bingo?
Only two. We shot in 68 and 69. The show, of course, ran forever in reruns. I think it's still running someplace. I'm not really sure. But they got as much material as they would ever need in shooting the 2 years. After all, you could put any dialogue you wanted into the mouths of the characters. if you wanted to update it or have tell a different story, whatever.
And you could also dub it in any language for that reason.
Yeah, I imagine they did. I've never seen it in another language, but I'm sure that's possible. I've seen some of the videos done with, like, Spanish subtitles, but I've never seen it dubbed in another language. But that's just me. I'm sure it's everywhere. But as for the videos, they were indeed videos, and we were really just, the show was really riffing on the monkeys. We pretty much existed, although the monkeys existed. The Banana Suits were ostensibly a rock and roll group, just like the monkeys. Mm. There were four of us, just like the monkeys, etc., etc. And in a way, the monkeys are animals, and so were the Banana Splits. You know, originally, the show was going to be called The Banana Bunch, but there was somebody else with that title, and so they changed it.
Now it's been
the rest is history.
It's been 50 years since the Banana Splits. You've now written this book. Why wait 50 years?
I was busy. I was doing other things. I was making movies and writing movies and so on. And then I was called to go and do a autograph signing session back in New Jersey in the fall of 2019. That was fun. And before I had a chance to do anything else, suddenly there was another call. Come do it in Los Angeles. And when I got back from L.A. to my home in Vancouver, I said, you know, if there's this much interest in this, I ought to sit down and dredge up whatever I can remember about doing the show. So I did. Interest equals activity. So there you are.
Are your brothers still around?
My younger brother is, after a fashion. My older brother, Jeff, is no longer. He passed away from a brain tumor in 2006, I'm afraid. My younger brother transitioned into being a woman a few years ago. And so yes and no, in a way.
How does your brother, or your now sister, I should say, feel about the book?
I don't know. I sent it to Anne. I haven't had any negative response, so I assume it's positive.
Now, a couple of years ago, and I say this unfortunately, a couple of years ago they made a Banana Splits movie. Well, last year it came out. Yeah. And they turned it into a horror story. I have not seen it. I don't want to see it, because to me that's not the Banana Splits. I just want to know if you had a thought on that.
Oh, I think it's a sacrilege. I did see part of it online. You can see anything online. I did not watch all of it. It's not well made. It's completely silly. How do you take these lovable characters and turn them into robot devils? You know, it's not a good thing. I doubt that there'll be a sequel.
Since the three of you, and I mean you, actually, since all four of you, those of you who play the Banana Splits, when you all came together, how was it decided, if at all, who would wear which costume? How did you end up as Bingo and not one of the other three?
It's a very viable question. We were driven out to where the costumes were at a little dance studio across the street from Hanna-Barbera on Cahuenga. I'm going back in my mind here so I can get it all right. And the costumes were lying in a big pile in their dry cleaning bags still. And my older brother, Jeff, and actually all my brothers are colorblind. So he chose this puce-colored dog costume of Flegel because he could see it and could react to it. Danny chose the lion because it was the tallest, and he was the tallest of the three of us. And that left me with Bingo, because clearly Storky was going to be somebody shorter than I was. So it was, process of elimination.
And over the period of time, did they give you direction as to how you were supposed to act as Bingo, or did you develop Bingo's personality as time went on? In other words, how much of Terrence Winkless is literally inside Bingo?
Nobody ever gave me any guidance toward how to behave as Bingo. That was all me. Anything that Bingo did, it doesn't take a lot to figure out how to make this bright orange guy with a huge grin look like an entertaining cartoon character come to life. it doesn't take a lot. If you behave a little bit like a monkey, combined with some kind of Marx Brothers character, there you go. You've got Bingo.
And all through the years post-Bingo, you've had a life where you've worked in films, you've worked in television, you've written, you've directed, all the things you've done. Whenever you sit down and you watch something like a sporting event and you see the mascots from UP to the Philly Fanatic, do you think, I was there, been there, done that?
Been there, done that, and have sweated the way that poor guy is in that costume. I imagine they aren't quite as hot in those costumes as we were. The thing is that we were under the lights, and the way you make it possible for a cameraman to keep track of you, keep you in focus, that is to make the lights go brighter. The higher the bright lights, the greater the f-stop, and that means you can you guys are more in focus the greater the light is. But the greater the light is, the greater the heat is. We went through 15 T-shirts a day under the costumes. So it was incredibly hot work.
Wow. Well, now people can read all about it. Your book is From the Inside, My Life as Bingo of the Banana Splits. Terrence, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure. Anytime. Do it again.
Terrence Winkless, author of From the Inside, My Life as Bingo of the Banana Splits. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0568, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here we are in the seventh inning stretch with Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Just give me a minute. I have to let me finish my stretching. That's it. Thank you. I thank President William Howard Taft for that one. So,
by the way, you've been stretching for as long as I've known you, and you're still the same height.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. No medieval rack can, add a few meters to my height. No. That's impossible. But, speaking of everything, in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look back at a team that's near and dear to a lot of people's hearts and felt they were ripped out when they left Montreal back in 2004. Because, it's hard to believe that it's been more than 15 years since the Montreal Expos played their final game ever at Shea Stadium in New York, where, ironically, they played their first game back in 1969, before they packed their bags and headed to Washington, D.C. and became the Nationals. And regardless of the fortunes that the Nationals have went through, including beating the Astros last year to win the World Series, the up-and-down history of Noza Mora fostered many fond memories that will remain in the hearts and minds of many of their mourning fans. And veteran writer and author Danny Gallagher is one of those fans. And so far, he has written 5 books about the Expos' glorious history on the diamond and their contributions to the world of Major League Baseball. You know, like those tricolor pinwheel hats, and Blue Monday notwithstanding. And with a 6th book called Always Remembered, Gallagher has tapped into his vast knowledge of the team that will certainly foster even more fond memories of the Expos and their unique collection of players who have literally stepped up to the plate. Now, the book's subtitle is New Revelations and Old Tales About Those Fabulous Expos, and believe me, there are plenty of both to satisfy any Expos fan of any generation. I mean, of course, there are stories that pay tribute to the players who put the franchise on the map, such as Rusty Staub and Gary Carter, Steve Rogers, Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, Larry Walker, and Vladimir Guerrero. But Gallagher pays fitting tribute to the players and personalities who were the team's overlooked and underrated unsung heroes.
And like by the way, for future reference, just to be perfectly clear, under no circumstances are you to mention the name of the city or team that now inhabits the spirit of said Expos, because as far as I'm concerned, they're dead to me. They don't exist. They never will exist. Do not mention it again. I'm warning you right now.
Yes, sir. I will not mention the...
Never?
Another team. Another team.
Yeah. Okay.
That other team.
Carry on.
It's like... Okay. So I was mentioning Elroy Face. He was the oldest living former Expo who played during the team's inaugural season. There was Mac Jones, the famed mayor of Jonesville. Chuck Taylor, the relief pitcher who was one of the rare bright spots during the Expos' mid-70s decline. And Mike Marshall, also a relief pitcher, but a rather eccentric person off the diamond, whose skills on the mound lifted the team to its first winning season in 1973. As well, the book is filled with a great deal of Expos stories that were relegated to the clubhouse and for most part are being revealed for the first time, much to the reader's delight. One of my favorites is the first time you read for the first time about when actor-director Ron Howard, who was a big baseball fan, put on an Expos uniform during a game at Dodger Stadium in 1982 because he was a good friend of then Expos hitting coach Billy DeMars, and he hung out in the dugout but was ejected by an umpire during the third inning because news photographers kept on taking pictures of Howard in his Expos uniform and they believed it was causing a distraction to the game.
Wow.
And there's even a picture of that of Ron Howard in that Expos uniform in 1982. It's a rare picture. And can you imagine if he would have bought the team?
Well, wait a minute. You're saying it's a rare picture. How rare could it be if you were saying the one of the things that was annoying to the umpire was the amount of people who were fawning over him and taking pictures? How rare can that picture be? There must be hundreds of them.
Well, maybe the first time seen since 1982.
Okay.
Okay. How's that?
Fair enough.
Okay, good. Now, it's this mix of the familiar and the never heard before that makes Always Remembered such an entertaining book. Gallagher has done a diligent job digging up so many facts and stories with the endless resources that were at his disposal, not to mention the countless interviews he has done with so many former players, journalists, broadcasters, and front office personnel that makes the book the long-awaited fitting tribute that the Expos so richly deserve. So whether you attended Expo games at Jarry Park or Olympic Stadium, remember Le Grand Orange, Bill Stoneman's no-hitters, Dennis Martinez's perfect game, and yes, even Blue Monday, you will never forget the Expos' colorful legacy and Always Remembered. As well, it certainly solidifies Danny Gallagher's reputation as the authoritative chronicler of the team that we've always affectionately referred to as Noza Mora.
And the book is entitled...
It's entitled Always Remembered, and it's published by Scoop Press, and it's $24.50.
And what other books in that genre do you suggest? And again, I warn you, if it's a book that even hints at where that team ended up, I don't want to hear about it.
No, I don't have any books about that other team.
Okay.
But I do have books about the Expos. In fact, I do recommend Danny Gallagher's previous Expos book, Blue Monday, which is a... thorough retelling of that black day in Expos history, or blue day, however you want to put it, and the events that led up to that much-remembered, painful 1981 NLCS series. And also, Up, Up, and Away, Jonah Carey, which I always recommend. It's the book of the the definitive history of the X-Files franchise, and which that was a book that I always felt that was long time coming, and I'm glad that it appeared. It's really a great definitive account of the story of the Montreal Expos from its early genesis in 68 right up till that final game.
And what about the writings of Brody Snyder?
Well, Brody did a couple of books, actually. He did one called The Year the Expos Almost Won the Pennant in 1979. And then a couple years later, he co-authored a book called The Year the Expos Finally Won Something. And those were big bestsellers here in Montreal.
Yep. And Brody Snyder was a great sports writer. He was an amazing human being. He is dearly missed, as far as I'm concerned. One of the sweetest men you will ever meet.
Yeah, you're right. And you know what? He was from that old school of sports journalism.
Absolutely. So again, this week's book is?
Always Remembered by Danny Gallagher. It's published by Scoop Press, and it's $24.50.
And how can people find you? Which dugout? The visitors or the home?
Well, the home, but not at that ballpark from that other team. But here in Montreal, and in the Montreal Times, you know, either in print or you can go online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. Now, where's those peanuts and Cracker Jack? Because I don't know if I'll ever get back.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here in this edition of the Stuff File program. I do have one more Stuff File news story to share with you, and of course, an idiot of the day. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Well, a Delaware man's lawsuit alleges he awoke from anesthesia after a colonoscopy procedure to find he had been dressed in a pair of pink panties. The Newcastle County Superior Court lawsuit, filed by attorney Gary Nietzsche on behalf of 32-year-old Andrew Walls, said Walls was employed by the Delaware Surgery Center in Dover when he underwent a colonoscopy procedure at the facility in 2012. Nietzsche said his client was put under anesthesia during the procedure and he awoke after surgery to find someone had dressed him in pink women's underwear. When the plaintiff initially presented for his colonoscopy, he had not been wearing pink women's underwear, and at no time did the plaintiff voluntarily, knowingly, or intentionally place the pink women's underwear upon himself, the lawsuit states. Jennifer Anderson, director of the Delaware Surgery Center, declined to comment. She said, "We just found out about this yesterday afternoon." The lawsuit, which also names the Eden Hill Surgical Group of Dover, alleges Walls suffered severe emotional stress, and Nietzsche wrote, his client is seeking compensation for mental anguish, lost wages, and loss of earning capacity. Oh, there are so many questions here. Number one. Did they just happen to have ladies' pink underwear in his size lying around? Number two, what happened to the underwear he was wearing when he came in? Number three, did he go home in said underwear or did he go commando? Number four, since he actually worked there, did someone have it out for him and why? Number five, me doth thinks he protests way too much. Why? Number six, questions four and five lead to a whole host of sub-questions that border on politically incorrect, so we'll stop here.
But you don't understand, Osgood. I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Yes. And now, boys and girls, it's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A troubling cluster of COVID-19 cases has been linked to a New York party host who knew they had coronavirus symptoms and threw a bash anyway. But attendees are refusing to work with health officials to contain outbreak. Health officials in Rockland County, New York, are investigating a cluster of 9 or more coronavirus cases that are linked to a large party. The blowout on June 17th in West Nyack led the host and 8 partygoers to test positive for the contagious respiratory virus. A crowd of up to 100 people, most in their early 20s, turned up to the house party, which violated a state order banning gatherings of over 10 people. It was the first of 3 large parties in Rockland County in the past 2 weeks. The other 2 parties, where guests are believed to have overlapped, were thrown on June 20th and June 27th. Officials say multiple people who attended one or more of the parties are refusing to cooperate with contact tracers, a strategy that is crucial to mitigating the spread of COVID-19, leading local officials to issue subpoenas. Rockland County Health Commissioner Dr. Patricia Rupert said in a press conference, "My staff has been told that a person does not have to or wish to speak to my disease investigators. They hang up. They deny being at the party, even though we have found their name from other attendees." Officials announced subpoenas will be issued to 8 non-compliant partygoers. Those who do not comply may face fines of $2,000 a day. Now, why? Oh, why? In a city and state that was the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, leading to a devastating death toll, would you callously and selfishly host a large party knowing you had the virus? And then you and your little sick friends are now refusing to cooperate with contact tracers to help stem the tide of another devastating outbreak? Well, there are several reasons. You're selfish, you're heartless, you're callous, you're a self-important narcissistic dweeb, and oh yeah, you and your little contagious friends are idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0568. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0568. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were to play this episode backwards, go ahead, try and figure that out.